Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, April 6th, 2025, is by Julian Hadley on the topic of forests, their services for humanity, and how we can measure them.
So this is George Perkins Marsh, who was an amazing Vermonter, came from Woodstock. And as it shows in the bottom, he was the first ambassador to Italy appointed by Abraham Lincoln. But in addition to this, he was a polymath. And according to the introduction to republication of his book, he could read fluently in 20 languages. And he thought a lot about nature. So next, Bruce. So he published this book, Man and Nature, and under the fine print is, or physical geography as modified by human action, in 1864, and it was republished 100 years later in 1964. And it's quite amazing the amount of information he acquired from historical sources documenting losses of forest. Okay, so I'm talking about the water cycle. This is, I think, a really nice illustration of the water cycle by a little book by Sally Ride, who you may remember was the first American woman in space, and her partner, Tam O'Shaughnessy. And it's a little called Mission to Planet Earth, Our World and Its Climate and How Humans Are Changing Them, from 2009. You see, like, when over the ocean, you have an evaporation of the ocean water, and it goes into the atmosphere. For some reason, there's no clouds formed in that diagram. But over land surface, like water bodies, you also have evaporation and clouds form. But what happens when you get into forests, so up here where it says trees, you have transpiration, so that's water coming out of the leaves of plants, which forms clouds and precipitation. And so you can get a great amount of water coming out of those forest-formed clouds. Okay, next, Bruce. Okay, so that explains how trees influence the water cycle, but why do they cool the climate so much? Well, of course, it's shady underneath the forest, and that's cool. But on a larger scale, what they do is, by evaporating water, they take tremendous amounts of heat from the forest and from the ground surface and send it to the atmosphere, because it's a little elementary physics. It takes 540 calories to evaporate a gram of water at 100 degrees C. And so that means 1 gram of water evaporating cools almost a pint of water. So a little gram of cubic centimeter cools by a pint. And of course, if you've ever stepped out of the shower into a dry room, or, you know, gotten out of a swimming reservoir, you know how quickly you feel cold because of evaporation. Okay, next, Bruce. And there's a really good summary of all this information on a USGS website, part of their water science school. And they have a lot of information on evapotranspiration and the water cycle. All right, next. So I'm going to change now a little bit. I'm showing you data about stream flow and how that's affected by forests and the nutrients, which I'll get to in the next slide. So there was an experiment done in 1965 to 1966 by Borman and Likens. This was the first sort of large ecosystem experiment to see how they affected the rest of the environment. And they had two treatments. They cut all the trees and killed all the herbaceous plants in one watershed, so that's this black symbols, and the other one was left alone. And can you go back one, Bruce? I think I skipped ahead. Yeah, here we go. So here's precipitation. Here's stream flow. So when they cut it down the forest, stream flow vastly increases, you can see right there. And evapotranspiration, this loss to the atmosphere, decreases. But they could only calculate this from the difference between precipitation and stream flow. And that was only to do that in certain places. Okay, next, Bruce, please, thank you. So these are the nutrients. So when they cut down the forest, all calcium comes flooding out of the forest, as well as potassium and nitrate. So it starts losing all those nutrients. And some of these are nitrate is very toxic to humans in water. So that's a very bad thing. Okay, next. So beginning, however, in the late 1980s, their whole new measurement technology, which is called eddy covariance, enabled the first direct measurements of carbon and water exchange between forests and the atmosphere. Next. And this is how it works, okay? The reason this works is the air flowing over a rough surface like a forest creates turbulence, which creates little eddies of air, little air moving in circular movements, which we can't see, of course. Although it's analogous to the little, you know, in a stream when you see water going into a pool and it moves around in an eddy, it's the same principle. And so if you can measure the concentrations of gas in these little eddies at very high frequency, then you can calculate how much of these gases are going out of the forest or into the forest. So here you have an upward moving part of an eddy, you have carbon dioxide, water vapor, and air temperature. You measure all of those, and you do the same thing in the downward moving eddy. And by the difference, so you have more CO2 coming out of the forest when the air goes up than when the air goes down. CO2 is coming out of the forest. And the same thing applies to water vapor. And you can also measure the temperatures. So this was really a genius idea. It's first proposed and used in the 1980s. The problem, and the reason it wasn't ever done earlier, is they need to measure these intervals must be less than 2/10 of a second. Okay, and so that's 18,000 measurements per hour, almost 500,000 measurements per day for each thing that you're measuring. So usually you need to measure at least six quantities. You want to know, you know, where you're measuring is what the fluxes are. You need the three components of wind, which are up, down, east, and east and west and north and south. You need the CO2 measurement, water vapor, and air. So that's about 2.5 million measurements per day. So it wasn't until computers were developed that could store a lot of information, as well as fast response sensors, that this could ever be done. And this is a little schematic I did of how it works over a forest. So you have wind blowing across the forest here from left to right. Oops, okay. You have wind blowing across the forest, and it creates all these little eddies that I've diagrammed here, these little dotted circular lines. And so in all those eddies, you have gases moving. So you have transpiration coming out of the forest here. That's water vapor moving up. You have carbon dioxide moving into the forest. That's photosynthesis. And you also have things coming from underneath the forest, primarily soil respiration, which was most of the carbon dioxide comes from. And you have a tower here with your sonic anemometer and your air intake port, and you have an analyzer in the shed down here to collect all the data. Okay, so this is really cool, and it works great in theory, but it doesn't always work in practice. And the number one problem that you might realize is that if you don't have enough wind, you don't have eddies, and you can't measure. And another one is that if you're on a slope, air tends to flow downslope at night, so you might have, you're losing your carbon dioxide here flowing downslope. So this works really well most of the time for measuring evapotranspiration, but not necessarily for carbon uptake, because you have this big variable down here, CO2 coming out of the soil. And unless you have a lot of wind, it doesn't make it up through the canopy. So next, Bruce. I'll show you some of the instrumentation. So this is a sonic anemometer on top of a tower at Harvard Forest that I used. There's an ultrasonic pulse goes back and forth between each of these pairs of transducers, they call them. And from the difference in frequency of these sound waves moving one direction and then the other, it can calculate the velocity of air movement in that particular axis. And so that's doing that 5 times a second. And then you have a gas coming in here. So this is a little cup with a filter in it, and tubes tucks it down into your gas analyzer on the ground. Okay, next. Now, more recently, there's been a modern technique where instead of sucking the air down to your gas analyzer on the ground, you have this is actually a gas analyzer that measures CO2 and water vapor in the open air. But there's tricky things about these, and some of the earliest, most respected people in this field aren't crazy about these, and I don't know how widely they're used, actually. Okay, next. So you have to have a tall tower to put your eddy flux system on top. This is one of the towers at the Harvard Forest. Next. People want to actually also be able to study the trees. So like when I was working, I measured photosynthesis of the branches, and respiration and stuff. And so I needed to get up there. And so this is a larger tower you can walk up, basically. There's a tall mask on the top that you can't really see, and that's where the eddy covariance instruments are on this tower. All right, next. So this was first done, the first long-term measurements, more than a few months, were done at the Harvard Forest, headed by an atmospheric scientist, Steve Wofsy, starting in 1991. But it caught on tremendously worldwide. So now there's a network of these flux towers all over the world. You see a lot in North America, a lot in Europe, quite a lot in Eastern China, Japan, and a fair number in Amazon here, very few in Africa. But there are now hundreds of places where these measurements are being made. And that's called FluxNet, the network. Okay, this is just a picture of the forest, the deciduous forest that I measured at Harvard Forest. This in the springtime, you can see all the new leaves coming out are kind of yellow-green. You see a few conifers, like a pine tree right there. That's Mount Monadnock in the distance. Okay, next, Bruce. And this is the other forest I studied, Hemlock Forest, in the winter. Next. And here it is in the autumn, and this was my brief moment of fame. I'm being interviewed by the NPR reporter named Dan Charles here, and actually got on All Things Considered for about 15 seconds. So it's really exciting to watch this process. And so this is just 1 minute of data on a computer screen, 1 minute of data, 10:24 a.m., August 11th, 2006. And it's showing you here the top three lines are the three different components of wind. This is vertical wind, north-south wind, east-west wind. And below that is the temperature that the sonic anemometer is measuring. And below that are the two curves that are really fascinating to watch. So this is carbon dioxide. It's going up and down. And here you say the carbon dioxide suddenly goes up. And at the same time, the water vapor goes down. So what's happening here is air is moving out of the atmosphere to the forest. So there's more, and this is during the daytime during photosynthesis, I should emphasize. So at that time, air is coming out of the atmosphere to the forest, and it's higher in CO2, but it's lower in water vapor. So, and you see this continuous pattern of these two lines, mirror images of each other. So there's a sudden increase in CO2 here, then there's a long decrease in the CO2, an increase in water vapor, and that's when air is coming out of the forest. So what you're seeing here is photosynthesis in action. This is the process by which all animals on the earth depend on. Next. Okay, so as I mentioned, there are problems with the eddy flux measurement, especially so if you have very calm weather, it doesn't work. And you know, you also have other reasons that there's gaps you need to fill, like lightning might strike your tower, which happened at least three times while I worked at Harvard Forest, and it knocks out all the instruments and you have to repair or replace them. So you have to be able to estimate what's going on when you're not actually measuring. And these are the things you need to measure. Light, which in the case of plants is called photosynthetically active radiation, although it's similar to the wavelengths that humans can see also. You need air temperature, soil moisture, hopefully. Nighttime air temperature if you're in a conifer forest, because in the cold weather, conifers like spruce, hemlock, will not photosynthesize if the night is too cold. They keep their little pores closed. And that was one of the first things actually I studied when I was a grad student in Wyoming back in the 1980s. You need to know vapor pressure deficit, which drives water evaporation, evapotranspiration. And you need to know what the day of the month or the year is, in the spring and the fall, because the foliage is either developing or senescing in a deciduous forest. Okay, Bruce. So this is some data I published, actually my last publication when I worked at Harvard Forest. And it's at that little Prospect Hill tower that I showed you with the deciduous forest around it. And this is the daily evapotranspiration in millimeters coming out of the forest over the year 2004 from June 30th to October 27th. And what you see here is that the deciduous forest is losing about twice as much water as the hemlock forest in the early summer here. And that difference decreases a bit over time. And then at the very end here, October 27th, deciduous forest is losing almost no water, and that's because there's no leaves on the trees anymore. whereas the hemlock forest keeps going. So there's about a 50% more water coming out of deciduous forest compared to hemlock forest. Okay, Bruce. And this gets really interesting when you compare it with precipitation. So this is precipitation, this blue line, which is measured at a meteorological station at Harvard Forest. And then you have evapotranspiration by the deciduous forest in red and the hemlock forest in green. And so the deciduous forest, which is this red line, is losing the same amount of water roughly as what's coming in precipitation. So there's no extra water. There wouldn't be any extra water to go into stream flow or groundwater recharge there. But the hemlock forest, the water use is considerably below the precipitation. So the hemlock forest allows more water to go into stream flow and also keeps streams very cool, which makes it a great habitat for brook trout, especially. And one of the concerns recently is that hemlock forest is dying because of terrible insect invasion. And that's going to have dramatic effects on habitat for some of these fish species. Okay, next, Bruce. Okay, so I've talked so far just about what's going on above ground in the forest. But what about what's going down on below ground? So this is a picture of part of the forest floor in the hemlock stand that I worked in with some mushrooms growing out of the duff here. And this is where the majority of the organic matter and the carbon in the forest is found. So I was astounded to learn when I started studying a forest ecosystem that there's way more carbon underneath your feet than there is over your head. And it's a very thick forest floor here. So at least this is true in sort of mesic, which is a moderately wet or a wet forest. So this is all, there's all this recycling going on down here. Next, Bruce. Recycling, breaking down organic matter by the fungi and making minerals, nutrients released. And you also have the roots in the forest floor. This is along a hiking trail. All this root system got exposed from this tree, but all the tips where all the growth and action is are still under the soil. And it's usually found that about 40% of the respiration coming in the soil is from roots, and 60% or so is from decomposition. Okay, next. And you can measure this pretty easily compared to what's going on above the forest. You can just put a collar, this is a white plastic collar that went on the forest floor. You cap it for a while and measure how fast the carbon dioxide increases. And that's what the soil respiration is. And I'm just measuring the temperature here at the same time, because temperature is the most important predictor of soil respiration. So this is some very, very long-term data, at least for the modern age, that collected at Harvard Forest from 1992 to 2016. And this was the study started by Steve Wofsy, an atmospheric scientist at Harvard, assisted by many, many other people. And so this is showing you cumulative NEP is just net ecosystem production, which is quantified in terms of grams of carbon per meter squared. So this is how many grams of carbon are being added to the forest per meter squared over this whole time. So this is the EMS Tower's deciduous forest. And what's cool, you can see every year how carbon into the soil goes up in the summer, and it goes down in the winter when the leaves aren't on the deciduous trees. But every year it's storing more carbon than is being lost in the winter. And so you get this long curve, and over 24 years, the forest has stored about 7,000 grams of carbon per meter squared, 7 kilograms or 15 pounds, roughly. So that's a lot of carbon going into the trees and into the soil. The other curves here, this is the hemlock forest, measured at the hemlock tower. And what's interesting is for this, it only started in 2005, and actually I made some of the early measurements on this. It's going up just as fast as the deciduous forest, which was kind of surprising because the hemlock forest is pretty old, like 100 to 200-year-old trees versus maybe 80 to 120 in the deciduous forest. And it was thought that these really old forests might not store very much carbon, but in fact it was until 2012, and that's when the insect, the hemlock woolly adelgid, started to kill the hemlocks, and it just levels off here. And if this was extended further, it would probably be going down. But initially, the hemlock forest stored a lot of carbon. Okay, then the final final curve here is the, this is was a tower set up in a clear cut, an area that had been just completely clear cut of basically spruce and pine trees. And what you see here is that the carbon's going down because there's no more trees there to take up carbon in the soil, and the rotting wood are losing carbon for about 5 years, and then it starts to go up again. So now there's more carbon being stored than what's being lost. And this is a paper with 25 authors. It was a huge, huge undertaking. There's many other kinds of measurements of the forest besides just this. All right, now you could go on to the next one, Bruce. And so this is another forest in the New England region. This is just a conifer forest with red spruce and balsam fir mostly, and some pines. I'm showing you the same thing I did in the previous figure in the top half here. This is amount of carbon being stored, accumulated every year. And so this was about 19 years, accumulated a little over 4,000 grams per square meter seed, or 4 kilograms per meter squared of carbon. And on the bottom here, you can see the year-to-year variation. So there is quite a bit, from only 150 stored in some years to over 300 in a couple of years. But still quite a substantial carbon storage. If it's 224, whoops, can you back one, Bruce? Sorry. Oh, back. Can you get back? Yeah, so it's 224 here and 298 here. So the deciduous forest here is storing about 30% more carbon than the coniferous forest did. Okay, so, and like I said before, there's data sets like this from all over the world now on the FlexNet. Now you can go to the last one, Bruce. So, of course, I mean, foresters and ecologists are used to studying actually what's, you know, how much wood and carbon there is in the forest, and I'm trying to add that up, are kind of skeptical of this atmospheric technique where you're just measuring, you know, 5 times a second these gases, and somehow that's going to tell you what's happening inside the forest. So there have always been measurements to check and to see whether those eddy flux measurements are reasonable. And actually with trees, it's not too hard to figure out how much carbon's going into the trees. You can put a metal band around the tree, like on this pine tree, there's two of them. And as the tree grows, the metal band will stretch, and you can measure the increase in circumference over time and calculate from that through some equations. You can estimate the total amount of wood and carbon being stored in the tree every year. And then you could, for the soil, it's a little harder to figure out what the storage is. You can measure everything that's falling down from the tree canopy, like dead leaves and branches and dead trees that fall over. So that's being added, and you can measure the soil respiration, what's coming out. So you can get a rough estimate that way. And if we could go back one more time, Bruce, it turns out that in both of these two studies, what's being stored in the wood above the ground is about 65 to 70% of the total, so about 30% is going underground. All right, I think that's it.